Hello, Capital Region. This is the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on WOOC 105.3 FM, broadcasting from the Sanctuary for Independent Media. I'm Livonia Mallory.
And I'm Bree. Today we'll be hearing from Mo Farrow and Corinne Carey.
We'll also be talking to Maria Walker, a firefighter for the Capital District.
Afterwards, we'll be having an interview with community engager Sean.
But first, let's do some rapid fire headlines. Transitional Shelter Assistance Program deadline for eligible Hurricane Irma and Maria survivors is going to be canceled. Families will be asked to move out of the shelter. FEMA offered to pay their one-way plane tickets to return to Puerto Rico. Over 1,660 displaced families in the United States may be forced to move out of the hotels by Saturday, where they have been living under FEMA Transitional Sheltering Assistance Program.
Prosecutors charged East Pittsburgh police officer Michael Rosefeld with criminal homicide Wednesday in the shooting death of 17-year-old Antoine Rose Jr. Court records show new details included in the criminal complaint against Rosefeld indicate Antoine was shot in his face, right arm, and the middle of his back. It also states that Antoine was in a car suspected in an earlier shooting but did not appear to be the shooter, and that Rosefeld made inconsistent statements about whether he believed Antoine had a gun when the officer opened fire.
In opening arguments during the preliminary examination for Robert Scott and Nancy Peeler, two officials in the Michigan Department of Health and Human Services Department, prosecutors said that Scott was involved in creating a report that falsely indicated no statistical significance rise in blood levels for children in the Flint area. Peeler buried the report of blood lead levels in children that showed a significant spike during the water crisis and joined with Scott to create a second report that claimed the changes in blood levels were not significant.
Democrats in Tennessee's largest county are accusing election officials of trying to suppress black votes in early voting preceding the August elections. Shelby County Democratic Party Chairman Corey Strong on Wednesday criticized the decision by the County Election Commission to make AgriCenter International the only open polling location on the first 5 days of the early voting process, which starts on July 13.
In Puerto Rico, water privatization plans are in effect. At a time when many Puerto Ricans often must boil their water before drinking it, this plan is supposedly misguided and inappropriate and embarks on yet another massive privatization overhaul of the system, says Food and Water Watch. PARSA can't afford another privatization failure now, says representatives. It should instead focus on basic services and ensure that every Puerto Rican has access to safe public water. For those of you just tuning in, you're listening to WOOC, Hudson Mohawk Magazine, on 105.3 FM.
To learn more about this program and how to support the Sanctuary for Independent Media, visit us online at mediasanctuary.org. If you have comments, suggestions, or warm regards, you can text us at 518-888-3004.
The New York legislature recently ended the 2018 session and left many criminal justice reforms unaddressed. WOOC correspondent Corinne Carey spoke with policy strategist Mo Farrow from the CATAL Center for Health, Equity, and Justice.
CATAL is a state-based organization. We're in both New York and Connecticut, and we work as a strategy hub and a collaborative partner to deploy our expertise in community organizing and policy advocacy. And CATAL is really focused on three goals that are interrelated, the first being to end mass criminalization, mass incarceration, and the war on drugs, also to advance health, equity, and justice in public safety and drug control, and to also build leadership and organizing capacity among local leaders, advocates, and community groups. So I work in Catal's New York City office to advance criminal justice reform campaigns in New York, and I have a particular focus on reforms that would reduce jail populations across the state, including bail and speedy trial reform.
The 2018 legislative session just ended, and there were a number of important criminal justice reforms before lawmakers this year. Can you talk about what they were and what happened this session?
Sure. So there was a lot of momentum for pretrial justice reforms in particular. So those are reforms that are aimed at reducing the number of people who are in jails who are awaiting the outcome of their case. So that's actually about 70% of people in jails across the state. They haven't been convicted of anything and should be presumed innocent in the eyes of the law. And the effects of pretrial detention are really devastating to individuals, families, and communities. Pretrial detention of just a few days can increase the likelihood of a new arrest, and it could lead to family instability, the loss of a job or housing or medical care. And then I should also say that there are really drastic racial disparities in pretrial practices. Black and brown people are more likely to be detained pretrial, and they're more likely to be offered more punitive plea deals. So there are three main pretrial justice reforms that lawmakers were considering this year. The first that really had the most momentum was bail reform. The majority of people who are in pretrial detention are there because they can't afford to bail themselves out. So bail reform would end wealth-based detention. It would confront and reduce racial disparities in pretrial practices, and it would ultimately take profit out of pretrial justice decisions.
Mo, can you give us an example of what happens when someone is arrested on, say, a low-level offense, and they come before a judge and are during a bail hearing? What happens that keeps them in jail?
Well, the judge ultimately has 9 forms of bail available to them, but they typically only set the 2 forms that are the hardest for people to afford. And so a lot of times people have, for example, cash bail that is set at such a high amount that they can't afford to pay it, and are therefore put in pretrial detention until, you know, the outcome of their case or until they can afford to pay bail. But, you know, there are a lot of people in pretrial detention for really small amounts just because they can't afford to pay it, like as low as $500 for a low-level offense.
And what kind of an offense would that be that would land someone in jail and be given that level of bail?
I mean, it could be anything from, you know, drug possession to, taking money from your grandma's purse. Really, low-level offenses that people should be able to fight for at home so they can continue their jobs and childcare and everything else.
Got it. So what would the bail reform that was on the table in Albany have done?
Well, there were a few different bills on the table, but ultimately, the common thread through the bills was that they would end cash bail for nearly all misdemeanors and nonviolent felony cases. And it would really promote the other forms of bail that are available to the judge so that folks can, work toward the outcome of their case at home.
And what happened to that reform? It seemed like there was momentum around it. There was support in the legislature. Why did it not pass this year?
So there was a lot of momentum. In the beginning of the year, Governor Cuomo included bail reform in addition to speedy trial and discovery reform in his State of the State address and his list of budget priorities. But ultimately, it didn't pass in the budget. And then we had another chance through the legislative session to get it passed through the Assembly and the Senate. The Assembly did pass a bail reform bill that was sponsored by Assemblymember Walker, but the Senate never brought it to the floor for a vote. So this session is now over and bail reform was not passed.
So we are speaking with Mo Farrell, the policy strategist with Catal in New York City. She has been working on bail reform issues along with other criminal justice reform issues in the state legislature on the Hudson Mohawk magazine this evening. Mo, were there any steps backwards from a criminal justice perspective this year in Albany?
Thankfully, the Assembly killed all of the criminal justice reform bills that would have taken us backwards. So no bills took us backwards, although the Senate did pass some bills that were wildly disappointing that would have increased penalties and prohibit parole for people convicted of certain violent felony offenses, but the Assembly killed those bills, and thankfully we didn't actually take any steps back for criminal justice reform this year.
The governor signed an executive order that would allow parolees to vote. Some people have said that he's sort of neutralized that issue. So, you know, not all parolees will now be able to vote, and it'll be very difficult to seek reforms in the future. What's your perspective on what happened?
I believe that, you know, this was a step forward just because there are some people who are able to vote now who couldn't before. And so, you know, I'm not as familiar with that executive order, but, you know, we would, of course, like anyone who is on parole or probation or even in prison, to have the ability to vote and speak their voice.
So what does Cattell's work look like in the next 6 months now that the legislature is out of session? What are you gearing up for next year? Will you bring the bail reform bill back?
Absolutely. And we'll be working with our partners to double down on our efforts and really continue our organizing and build power to hold Albany accountable. So, you know, the first step is to evaluate the outcomes of our session, check in with our partners, and revisit the bills we've been pushing for to see how they can be strengthened. But we'll also be actively engaged with the upcoming elections in November to ensure that folks in our communities know who their candidates are and to make sure that they're prepared to vote, because that could really change things up for 2019.
What other reforms would you like to see the state legislature address that would promote fairness and equity in our criminal justice system?
So in addition to bail reform, there were a couple of other pretrial justice reforms that passed the Assembly but didn't make it through the Senate, first being speedy trial reform that would ensure that cases go to trial in a reasonable time frame, because right now our speedy trial law is riddled with loopholes that cause extensive court delays, and they lead to long periods of detention for people who have been charged but haven't been convicted of anything. So sometimes people are in pretrial detention for months or years because of the loopholes in our speedy trial law. We'd also love to see discovery reform passed. In a criminal case, discovery materials include the evidence that's collected during the investigation and prosecution of charges. So that's police reports and statements of witnesses and other forms of discovery. And New York's current law doesn't require district attorneys to turn over discovery materials to defendants until the day trial actually begins. So that leaves defendants blindfolded to the evidence that's against them. So early and automatic and open file discovery would bring New York in line with the best practices across the country, so that defendants and their attorneys know what they're up against and they can properly prepare for their cases. There was also another bill that would restrict the use of solitary confinement that passed the Assembly toward the end of session. So that is the practice of locking people up in small cells for up to 24 hours a day without meaningful human contact or programming or therapy. And again, that passed the Assembly but did not pass the Senate. So those are just some of the other bills, but there are really, you know, a host of reforms that we need to our criminal justice system in order to make it more fair.
I want to go back to what you said about discovery and how New York's laws around discovery for criminal defendants are not very transparent. Do district attorneys have the obligation to turn over evidence that would exculpate a defendant? Say they have a statement from a witness that another person may have committed the crime. Is that something that the DA is obligated to turn over to the defendant's attorney?
Right now, the law is functioning so that they do not actually have to turn it over until the day trial begins. So discovery reform would turn that around so that that is information that the defense would have to have early on in the case.
Got it. Mo, where can folks find out more information about what Cattell does and about the bail reform issue and the other criminal justice reforms that that your organization is working on in New York?
Yeah, you can always visit us at our website, which is cattellcenter.org. Cattell is K-A-T-A-L. There you can read more about the work that we're doing, sign up for our newsletter. You can also follow us on social media at Cattell Center. And folks can always email me at mo@cattellcenter.org. It's just M-O.
That was Mo Farrell, policy strategist with the Catal Center for Health, Equity, and Justice, talking to WOOC correspondent Corinne Carey about state criminal justice reforms.
Next, we have another Reclaiming History segment talking about firefighters. We have a brave firefighter with us today, Deputy Chief Maria Walker of the Albany Fire Department. She was first woman in this position, and she's going to tell us everything about firefighters. She is a second or third generation firefighter, Chief, welcome to WOOC.
Thank you for having me.
So listen, tell me about firefighting. Is it true that firemen are still running into burning buildings?
Well, we prefer safety, so we don't run. But okay. Yes, they move quite quickly, and we do still go into burning buildings.
So you are a third generation firefighter?
Yes, third.
And so did you start in the fire station with the men sleeping overnight? I mean, I only know about firefighting from watching TV.
Like, I did. I started as a firefighter, EMT, which is emergency medical technician.
So you actually stayed in the fire station with the guys?
I did. Yes.
Is it true you guys cook great food in the fire?
They cook great food. I can't say that I'm a great cook, but I've eaten some excellent food in the firehouse, yes.
So what do you have to do to be a good firefighter? Like, what do you have to know to be a good firefighter?
Well, critical thinking is important.
Okay.
Being able to make a decision in a split second is valuable, very important.
Wow.
The civil service exam for firefighting consists of general knowledge information, math and science, about to the ninth grade level.
Okay.
And then you need to pass what is called the CPAT, the Candidate Physical Agility Test.
Is that when you have to carry a person out of a building or upstairs or
something? It consists of seven stations. It's a 10-minute and 20-second test that begins with 3 minutes on a step mill, wearing 75 pounds to simulate the gear that we wear.
Mm-hmm.
And then they put it down to 50 pounds when you complete the step mill and you finish the rest of the stations, and they mirror firefighting skills.
So everyone does that, male, female?
Yes.
Everyone
has to be able to pass it.
Wow.
It's a nationwide exam.
And once you pass the exam, you get appointed as a firefighter, and then are you assigned? Is everyone assigned to a truck, or is there desk duty? Because that's what I would be doing, desk duty.
We went right to the firehouse.
Really?
Yes.
So why did you want to be a firefighter? Why?
Well, to be perfectly honest, I wasn't my life goal. I was headed to law school.
Oh, fires, law school. Okay.
Well, my father, who was a firefighter in the city of Buffalo, said, "You're old enough, take the exam." And I said, "That's not what I want to do with my life. I'm going to law school."
Okay.
And he encouraged me to take the exam, and I did. And for the city of Albany, you're required to be an emergency medical technician. And his response to me when my grades came back from the fire exam were, "Well, you did pretty well. Why don't you go become an EMT?" And my response to him was, "Well, why? I'm not going to be a firefighter." And he said, "First aid is a great life skill to have. Knowing what to do in an emergency, whether you become a firefighter or not, it's useful information." And I followed his advice. I was 19. I do what my father said to
right.
get him off my back.
Your obedient daughter.
No? I resisted.
Okay.
So I did that. And then the letter came from the city that said, "We'd like to offer you a position." And once again, I turned to my father and said, "Why? This isn't what I want to do."
Mm-hmm.
He said, "Try it. If you don't like it, you can always quit." And I didn't quit. It's the best job in the world. If you ask any firefighter, they'll tell you they have the best job in the world.
And what is it that makes it the best job in the world, really? Number one and number two.
Well, I think it's different for every person.
Okay.
For me, I find it a double-edged sword to say that I like my job, I love my job. If you think about what I do, I'm helping people, and we're helping people at the worst point in their lives.
Mm-hmm.
Their loved one is sick. They are sick. Their house is burning. So for me to go to work, somebody else is suffering. So it's hard to say I love my job. But what I can do is be there to help. We mitigate the problem, try to make things lessen. And that's what I love about my job, is the being able to help part.
Now, I know for some other civil service jobs, there's like a height requirement and all of that. None of that.
Not for
a short woman like me. Well, young, like Bree, probably.
There's no age requirement. So in the city of Albany, which is really what I can speak to, there's a civil service exam, that general knowledge information.
Mm-hmm.
you're required to be an emergency medical technician. Departments in other areas may or may not require that. Some require paramedics level training. Some require first responder training. Some require no medical training. It depends on the department.
Okay.
For the city of Albany, we require an emergency medical technician.
So that's the EMT. That's the guy who rides the ambulance, and if something happens.
Well, we ride fire trucks in Albany. Yes, all of our firefighters are either EMTs or paramedics.
Okay.
And we can't transport you in a fire truck. So when we respond to a medical call, Mohawk Ambulance responds with us to transport you to the hospital.
And so, what sort of equipment do you have that you have to learn to use as a firefighter?
The trucks.
Driving the truck.
Driving the truck.
Which is pretty big.
Running the pumps.
Okay.
How to place the hoses, where to place the hoses, where to place the ladders.
Now, is it true that that hose can knock you down if you don't ground yourself?
If the pressure's heavy enough. But
okay. But generally speaking, no, you're okay.
You're okay.
An average person can hold the fire.
You learn how to do it. That's part of the training. You don't need any fire training to actually join the fire department. You'll get all of that in recruit school.
And how long is recruit school?
For us, it's 14 to 16 weeks.
That's a long time.
There's a lot of training requirements.
So in 14 weeks, what are some of the things you have to learn in this 14-week class?
Everything I just told you. Ventilation. Where to place the truck. Mm-hmm. How to put the fire out.
Mm-hmm.
How fires burn, the path they take, the pattern they take.
You have to learn that too.
Mm-hmm.
Now, go ahead.
Considering that you wanted to go to law school and that you didn't go to law school, what would you say are the links between being a firefighter and what you would have been doing had you went to law school?
Probably the critical thinking and decision making.
Mm-hmm.
That's probably the most similar. They're very different, though. There's not...
What advice would you give to a young person, considering that you joined the fire, you became a firefighter, and you love your job, coming from a place of wanting to go to law school? What would you say to a young person who might either be in a similar situation or are trying to figure out, you know, what route to take and why?
That's a good question. I often talk to middle school, high school kids, and I tell them the same thing my father told me. Try it. If you don't like it, you can always move on.
Yeah.
Whatever you want to do in your life, you make the best decision you have with the information that you've got at the time. And if it turns out it's not a good decision, once you're more informed, you can make a different one.
Mm-hmm. Earlier you mentioned critical thinking being so important as a firefighter. What is an example of some critical thinking you'd have to exercise while on a fire? Like, what does that mean? For someone who may not even know when you say critical thinking.
We start with our life safety and then the life safety of the public.
Okay.
Our life safety usually comes first, not because we're more important, but if we're part of the problem, we can't help mitigate it.
Right.
Knowing that how fire spreads and the path that it takes and the chemical reactions that go on, finding the seat of the fire and putting it out so it doesn't spread, knowing the decision, am I going to do this job first? Am I going to do that job first? What portion of my job needs to be done in which step?
So I recently bought a house, and my uncle said, make sure you get a fire extinguisher mm-hmm. for every room. This is what he said. No, he said for the kitchen, for your bedroom, and for downstairs in the basement where all of the furnace and everything is. So, you know, like you, obedient, I went and I bought these fire extinguishers. And I put them in the places that you're supposed to. He told me to put them in. And I told a friend who was visiting, I was so proud. I have a fire extinguisher in the basement next to the furnace. And he said, if the furnace starts rumbling, the fire extinguisher is not going to help you. The house is just going to go boom, you know.
Get out. Call 911.
Call 911. So what are some of the things you would tell the average person who's a homeowner or in an apartment in terms of what they need to have in their house or what they should do to make sure or to decrease the possibility of a fire?
Decrease the possibility of a fire. Candles not left unattended, you know. That is probably valuable. Don't overload outlets.
Okay.
You have a grease fire in the kitchen, don't pour water on it.
Mm-hmm.
Put a top on the pot. Okay. I do have a fire extinguisher in my own kitchen.
You do?
I do not have one in the basement or the bedroom, though. Smoke detectors, working smoke detectors.
Okay.
Not pulling the battery out because it went off from steam or smoke in the kitchen is valuable, very important. That early alert. So many years ago when furniture and things were made out of cotton and wood, fire doubled in size roughly every minute.
Okay.
Because of technology, if you look around your house, people have large screen TVs, they have computers, they have wires, they have furniture that wears better, carpet that wears better. Those are mostly made of petroleum products. Your home is fuel for that fire. And fire now doubles in size roughly every 30 seconds. So that early alert from a smoke detector to get out of your house is the best thing.
So petroleum products, polyester is one,
it's
right?
Fuel for the fire.
That can cause the fire to move faster than like a piece of
faster.
Cotton. I had no idea. Did you
petroleum
know that?
Products know burn that. Differently.
I didn't know that. I knew there's a reason why I don't like polyester.
What would you say has been the most is, I think, very hard, but the most important or most pressing lesson that you've learned from work that's seeped into your personal life?
The teamwork, the value of the people that I work with, knowing that they rely on me and that I can rely on them. It is a family, and like a family, there's personality issues. Sometimes we get along, sometimes we don't get along, but that the value of teamwork and just knowing that somebody's going to be there. We go into fires in teams, and we stay together. We work together, and the ability to work with others.
So if you're just tuning in, you're listening to us talking to having an interview with Deputy Chief Maria Walker of the Albany Fire Department. We're talking about firemen and why people want to do this job. You know, when I was doing a little research on the history of firefighters, there was a lot in the history about the Irish people being involved in firefighting.
Yes.
You know, did you tell me you were Irish?
I am. My maiden name is McGarry.
I think that's pretty Irish, right?
It's very Irish.
So why did the Irish men, or I'm assuming back in the 50s and 40s in the past, why did they get involved in firefighting? Why was that an attractive profession for Irish immigrants?
I honestly don't think that it was. The information that I've read on that, back in the early 19th century, when the Irish saw the signs on buildings that said, Irish need not apply. They were left with the jobs that no one else wanted. This is what I've read about it.
Okay.
The dirty jobs, the dangerous jobs, firefighting and police officers. And that's how it seemed that there were many Irish in firefighting.
So now the fire departments are changing, obviously. There are more than just Irish men on the fire department. We have a female deputy chief. I'm sure we have African Americans on the fire department. Is the
a wide variety.
Is it changing? Is there a wide variety?
Yes, I think there is. The interesting thing is fire departments have taken a look at that and are working to make the department more reflective of the community they serve. And the Albany Fire Department has done that. Our recruitment efforts center around having our department reflect the city of Albany.
And is that a good thing with to have that diversity within the department? Because, you know, people talk about all the men living together and it was this camaraderie of men, and now you have the women interjected into the fire department and maybe someone that doesn't look like them. Has that changed the fire department in any way for the better, or, you know, for the are there issues?
I would say for the better, but my opinion may not be the same as someone else's.
I think, what do you think? You were in the fire
I was. And when I first started, there were people who were not thrilled I was there and people who were very accepting, but I don't think that that's solely a firefighting issue. I think that's similar in any profession that you're in. So for me, my standard when I got there, it was unusual at the time. I was the fourth female hired in the department, and I've always said that the three girls that were hired ahead of me paved a very wide path. I was extremely lucky.
Wow.
And I really just had to walk down that path. There was some stumbling along the way, but I am grateful to them, those three women that were hired ahead of me, just made it easier for
me. Easier for you. So when is the next class of firemen coming through? Do you have to take an exam? Do you give the exam every year, once a year, every 6 months? How does that work?
The exam can be given, usually it was given every 2 years. Mm-hmm. I believe the next test, the list has been extended by civil service to be 4 years. So okay. We will be having an exam, I believe, coming up in 3 years. But there's plenty to do in that time. It seems like a long time, mm-hmm. but with the requirement to be an EMT, it's not a weekend course. That is a 6 month course.
Okay.
Depending on when you take it. If you take a class that's offered during the day, Monday through Friday, it's a shorter course than if you're doing it two nights a week. But it can take up to 6 months.
So for people to be ready for the next test, which you said is going to be given in 3 years, they need a 6 month lead time in order to prepare for the EMT, pass it successfully?
Well, you don't need it to take the exam.
Oh, you don't? Okay.
You don't. But that's something they could do in the meantime.
Okay.
Classes are usually offered in colleges and around the area. It's a basic first aid.
You're right. Well, listen, Chief, we thank you so much for coming in and telling us about all things fire.
Thank you for having me.
That was Deputy Chief Maria Walker of Albany Firefighters Department, an aspiring firefighter.
For those of you just tuning in, I'm Lavonia Mallory.
And I'm Bree. You're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on WOOC 105.3 FM Troy.
So next, I guess we're going to be talking to Bree about her being an intern here at the radio station. She's my host today, and she is an intern, and she came in. Where you're from? Tell us where you're from.
I am from Cleveland.
Cleveland.
Yeah.
And she is an intern, and she's been with us a great time, and I'm so glad she's with us. But now we're going to go on to our next segment. Last week, 3-day design, Charlotte on the development of the Monument Square continues to resonate with the greater Troy community. Our correspondent Dave Pablo has a few excerpts from last Thursday's gathering.
This is part two of our story on Troy's recent One Monument Square design charrette at the Art Center of the Capital Region. In its March press release, the city defined design charrette as follows. Quote, a charrette is an intensive planning and design session where residents, business owners, designers, and other stakeholders collaborate on a vision for development. A design charrette provides a forum for ideas which offers a unique opportunity to give designers immediate feedback while creating mutual authorship among participants in the plan. End quote. In part one, I reported on the first meeting of the charrette, a 3-hour presentation and workshop meant to gather community ideas. That occurred on a Monday. On the following Wednesday, the design team gathered people again to talk about what the response had been, what that could mean as far as the structures and layout, and what factors might mitigate the process. For example, various people had recommended interactive space, or civic space, housing, office space, parking, etc. But large sections of the property in question fall within the floodplain, and so there are restrictions on use of that land. However, the overall consensus indicated that people wanted a community space with a connection to the river. On Thursday, the design team, represented by Margaret Irwin, co-founder of River Street Planning and Development, Ian Law, the director of urban planning and design at Place Alliance, and Jeremy Kay, founder of Studio JDK, came back with a more refined design. I'm going to play back a portion of Ian Law's presentation and some excerpts from the Q&A. The basic ideas are the community people who showed up for the charrette predominantly want an interactive space oriented around a civic/community purpose. That said, there are developers and other people with financial interests in all this who thus far have preferred closed-door meetings, and they will almost certainly want a piece of the pie. Here's Ian Law.
So one of the big things that we've tried to kind of incorporate in all of our iterative process was finding a big civic indoor flexible space that potentially could take on the market or any other kind of flexible uses in the winter to have a more permanent home as well as just potential for other uses to take place in a civic way. And so the idea was to kind of shift it over to one side so that we could create this great outdoor civic environment. But to do that and to pull people out onto this space, but make it feel contained so it just didn't bleed away. We also wanted to kind of line it. So we added some smaller architecture piece that would get contain that street wall with nice, exciting architecture, and kind of start to frame the view sheds out into the space, as well as created opportunities for smaller kind of venue spaces. So within this space, and you're going to kind of, again, you're going to get to see all of this in three dimensions, which is a lot easier to understand. Over here where that blue box is, that would be a smaller venue. In the park, you know, you've got this great venue for thousands and thousands of people. But when a smaller event there, they feel like they're in the ocean. It's a huge space and it doesn't have the energy it needs for smaller events. So the idea here is we want this to be able to take on the personality that it can be everything. Also helping to kind of contain the space and anchor the view of the park. It's potentially a commercial space, like a great bar grill type place that can take advantage of those vistas from an elevated perch, draw you in, help to activate that plaza space, and take advantage of the fact that we've got to step down into it. My partner Mark was talking about how a lot of the goals of this is how do we get down, how do we connect Monument Square down to the park in a really elegant way that works for everyone. So really, it needs to be this big pivot. No matter how we slice it, the One Monument Square development is really the southern terminus of the Riverfront Park. There's a natural pinch point with the existing building that sits over here. And so, you know, whatever's done there is going to kind of anchor that southern end. And so it just makes a lot of sense to really engage it in a beautiful way and have an elegant and interactive way of getting up and pull you into downtown. So that's something that this is trying to do. I want to show you a few other slides, I think we're going to get into this, that just kind of talks about some of the things that we think that this space can do. So I'm just going to kind of flip through some imagery. Don't get caught up too much on the exact styles of the architecture or things, but it's more about some of the uses and functions that would be able to take place, because we think it represents a lot of what we heard over the course of these
days. And we chose these because they were more of the size of Troy and the size of the site?
Yeah, for the most part, that they we think that they're contextually make a lot of sense. So everything from, you know, movies on the plaza. It's big enough that you could, you know, have a seasonal ice skating rink and then take it down, and then in the summertime it's back to just being this great flexible plaza, and there's fantastic examples of it that we've scaled, and it could fit and still have plenty of pedestrian circulation to get around and be an exciting thing. It's where you put your Christmas tree, and then you can see this is that space. So back in the summer it just goes back to being great plaza space. Food festivals can happen all within that space. Anything that you can imagine, really. Again, from large, you know, 1,500, 2,000 person venues that would really be exciting in a spot like that, to stuff that's smaller, doing yoga or exercise out there in large groups. So, you know, weddings, graduations, backyard kind of elements could all happen in this space, and that's kind of the key, is just keeping it flexible. That brings us to a couple points that we had to do to kind of make some of the commercial partners, the private partners of this, potentially as part of the public-private partnership. In the big volume where the market space could be, we think maybe something that could be logical would be to add some commercial. So effectively, commercial office over top of 2 to 3 stories of the flexible market space, which, you know, potentially helps to start to fund this.
And here's one of the many astute comments from audience members.
I just want to, reiterate that I think this is a great concept. I like a lot of the visualness of it, and I like the uniqueness of it. I just got back from Buffalo, and so they just recently redid a whole area of downtown that was useless into Canal Side, which is very Buffalonian, and it now draws a ton of people. It's really vibrant, and I can see this being that for Troy, something uniquely Troy. But I guess one comment in addition is Buffalo somehow figured out how to fund that. Uh-huh. And so if we talk to Buffalo, or and what did you guys do? Where did you get the funding? Because it's there's some commercial, but there's a lot of open civic space. Yeah. I think that would help with the funding aspect.
We have the ability to do that as the partners. Yeah, it's a good suggestion.
And here's Margaret Irwin responding to my question.
So regarding the comment that you just made just now about there being like a month and various stakeholders, you know, reviewing this kind of thing, how transparent is this going to be? Are we going to know, you know, who these stakeholders are, what they're really looking for?
I think that the idea with coming at this way is that it's a transparent process. You sometimes have to have a conversation with someone quietly so that they feel like they can tell you the whole story. You do, and I'm not going to tell you that that won't happen and doesn't need to happen, but. Coming back, every step in this process, I hope, will come back to you. What's the potential RFP look like? What are the criteria we might use, we, Troy, might use to judge ideas that come in? Can we make sure that they submit information so we can compare A to B to C? What are we going to ask for, specifically, by square foot? Who want to go out saying, the ownership of this piece is settled. It's going to operate this way. Will we know that? Those are all questions we should continue to talk about. And then when proposals come back, we should talk about them. And there are pieces of that that are private. People provide financial information. You need them to do that. You want to know something. Maybe that's not the public piece. But as much as possible, while still creating a process in which someone will participate, this should continue along this path, and you shouldn't, I feel, you shouldn't have to react to something. You should just be part of the process of reviewing and making choices. We will not get everything we want, no one ever does, but we can make choices, and the community can make choices together to a greater degree than we might have in the past, and that's not a fault of anybody, it's just a different way of going forward. So my hope would be, it's as transparent and as open for as long as it exists, and but that's going to be on all of us to keep, you know, coming together and doing it.
So where does this project go from here? Margaret Irwin indicated that the process will likely slow down somewhat through August, but pick back up again in September. If you are concerned about where this project goes from here, probably best to keep up with it. For Hudson Mohawk Magazine, I'm Dave Pablo.
We'll have more time on the redevelopment process at Monument Square as the process continues. Next, the Hudson Mohawk Magazine brings you.
Our next guest is a regional entrepreneur who recognized a niche business in our overflowing lives and left the social justice nonprofit sector to build a company dedicated, as she puts it, to turn the mountains of our lives back into molehills. Thank you so much.
Pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Tell our listeners your name and the name of your company.
I definitely will. Sheila Sable. I am the owner of Call Sheila, your personal concierge and senior move specialist, and been in business for a little while.
Okay. So tell us about this concierge business.
Sure.
What is that exactly?
Okay. So the concierge business is not unique. It's nationally there's dozens and hundreds of concierge folks basically doing errands, projects, tasks for people who are busy, people who have very busy lives, people who have, you know, four kids and a couple of goats and two jobs, and they need somebody to fill in extra set of hands and help out. I have somebody working for me now and a couple of, Call Sheila team. You know, we do all kinds of errands, projects, tasks for people. And, it's very exciting to be able to help when people need us.
I got so excited because I remember when Corin was telling us about you, and I got so very excited because I think, at least for me personally, what you do it illuminates possibility in the world, because that's something that I just love to do, just period. And so to think that, you know, you can start a business and then you can do it, just, you know, is something that I find to be awesome. And you have an interesting job, and the story behind how and why you built it is just as interesting. Can you tell us how and why you found it called Sheila?
Sure. So as a young kid, I was one of these parentified people, therapy term, right? You know, older parents who couldn't find their way out of a paper bag, so to speak. So I was always worried about them, and I had to learn how to do lots of different things and, you know, to make sure they were okay. And, you know, as I aged into, you know, my teenage world and my young adult world, you know, that burden of the parentified youngster became, you know, a lot of gifts. And I was somebody who could really do a lot of things. And if I couldn't do it, I could figure out who to call and how to make it happen. And, you know, I'm just one of those people who gets things done. Can I curse on here? Can I say get
no,
shit done?
No, you can't. You can't.
Okay. So, so sorry. So, you know, I get things done, and you know, as things progressed in my life, it was one of those things where friends literally would say, "You can't see the eye roll on the radio," but it'd be just like, "Call Sheila, she'll do it." So that's how I got the name of the business. That's how
call
the business.
Sheila, she'll do it.
Yeah.
Okay.
And you know, and I've worked in the nonprofit sector for 30 years or so, and been trying to start this business formally for a long time, and then there was just some timing that was really right almost 3 years ago.
So has your business grown and expanded in different ways, unexpected ways?
Yes, absolutely. As we've been talking about, the concierge part is, you know, I envisioned it as, you know, Sheila Sable kind of buzzing around town, you know, taking care of people's business and, you know, delivering this or making this happen, planning events or staffing events or whatever. And then there all of a sudden there was a lot of requests for helping people, maybe predominantly seniors, kind of downsize and transition to different living space, mm-hmm. whether they're staying in their homes, you know, they need to reconfigure certain things, or if they're moving into senior communities or assisted livings, you know, those are things with a lot of logistical balls in the air kind of thing.
Absolutely.
And, you know, I manage that stuff really well for other people.
So just getting things out of the house,
mm-hmm.
selling things if you have to.
Yeah, you know,
declutter things.
Absolutely. And you know, the donations and, you know, getting things to charities. But also, you know, I know a lot of people who, you know, live in ways where they don't always have access to what they need. You know, there's a lot of people living in poverty in this city and the capital region. So I know people, and I try to get things to people, and I have a lot of clients that are, you know, very willing to skip that charitable contribution. Like, I don't need the documentation that this went to a charity. Just get it to somebody who needs it. So right. I furnished somebody's home, a young man just out of jail for a couple of years and, you know, trying to get back on his feet and, you know, establish a home so he could have his kids back. And I furnished his whole house because the client was cool with it. And, you know, it was great.
I like that ideal of, you know, because I think you're right. I think there are a lot of people who have a lot of stuff. And when they get ready to get rid of their stuff, they don't necessarily care if it goes to some charity that's then going to sell it to mm-hmm. someone. They actually want to make sure it gets to someone who really needs it because it's their stuff
mm-hmm.
and it may be nice stuff,
mm-hmm.
but they don't want it to go to waste. Mm-hmm. That's great.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know, I try to not counsel, but really try to bring my clients to that point where it's like, I always ask, how much of a benefit is this charitable contribution documentation really going to be for you? Does it outweigh, you know, being able to furnish somebody's apartment who, you know, doesn't have any pots and pans or linens?
So it seems like you've carried over the activism spirit a little bit, huh?
Oh, yeah. Couldn't live without that.
Yeah. Yeah. Tell us a little bit more about that.
Sure. So, you know, I started the business right after the organization that I used to work for closed their doors. It was LGBT advocacy, statewide work, marriage equality, attempting to pass the Gender Expression Non-Discrimination Act through the state legislature. You know, and I was an activist and an organizer and the director of education and outreach for the Empire State Pride Agenda. And, you know, that was a job that was an organization with a great mission. But, you know, sometimes the people leave a lot to be desired. And let's just say, you know, muddy things up in ways that they don't really have any idea what they're doing. So I was planning to start the business in June of 2016, and I was plotting and planning and doing things on the side while I could, you know, do my job, but also, you know, get this foundation for Call Sheila. And then the organization closed its doors. One of those moments in time where they're like, yeah, we've done everything we need to do. We're done, you know. And so good that they did that, because they weren't really helping too much. But it did leave a void in the state. And, you know, there's still a lot of work, obviously. Back then there was still a lot of work. Now, you know, we're living in a time where, you know, it's hard to breathe every day. So, you know, and it's, I have a lot of freedom now. You know, I'm an entrepreneur, I do my own thing. And one of the things I try to do when, you know, sometimes I have clients who I know are not agree with me politically. So, for example, I went to a woman's house and I saw one of those, anti-reproductive freedom bumper stickers. You know, and I don't talk about that with the clients, but as soon as I leave and as soon as they pay me, I make a donation to Planned Parenthood, you know. So if I know I'm dealing with, you know, somebody who supports, you know, gun rights, you know, I make donations to organizations that work for, parole justice and that kind of thing. So, you know, I try to balance, because I'm earning a living and I'm able to do those types of things. But I am working all the time, so I'm exhausted. So I can't really be in the streets the way I was.
Can't march, yeah, because you're sleeping.
So. You're not only a woman-owned business. You define the business as much more than that. What are some of the challenges you faced in running your business, particularly in this political climate? You talked just a little bit about it just now. Or have there been some advantages?
So, yeah, there's both. I mean, my demographic is, you know, people need to be able to pay, right, so that I can support my business and support myself, right? It's not, I wish it was a free service, but just for today, it's not. So, rich people are getting richer in this climate. So that is, you know, it's a benefit, right? That's my demographic, people who can pay. And those people, their income, they're seeing a bump in their income because of what's going on. I have to admit that is definitely there. Some of the detriment is, you know, there are more and more people living in poverty. I get phone calls all the time from people who can't afford that, and it's heartbreaking. And then just as personally, I've been sexually harassed by a 95-year-old man. I've had a woman greet me in a towel, you know, opening the door. Like, so there's those weird things that I wasn't kind of expecting. I'm a strong feminist. I forget sometimes that, you know, I'm vulnerable in the world, you know? So those were two moments where it's like, oh, what do I do here? I need this gig. Right. And so it was like, oh, I am being sexually harassed. Or potentially, if I get this gig, I'm going to be working with this guy. I didn't get the gig, so.
So when you're not, fighting them off, Sheila.
No, God, I don't see it that way. But go ahead.
What are some of the other unique things you have to do in your new job? I mean, what are some things people ask you to do in their home?
One really unique thing was I had a woman call me and say, can you help us find the perfect puppy for our family? So that was really cool.
What kind of dog did you find?
They ended up with a golden doodle.
A golden doodle.
Golden doodle.
Okay.
And that was kind of a fun thing. I had to kind of interview the parents, and then they had to interview the kids about, you know, or I don't know if they actually interviewed the kids. Anyway, at the end of it, you know, they had a cute dog. I had a cute picture of a family with a cute dog.
Right.
And, you know, it was good for my website, and it was fun. And there wasn't a lot of heavy lifting there. So that was kind of cool. The other day, my zaniest client, I have this client who uses the concierge stuff really well. Sometimes I pick up laundry. Sometimes I schedule focus groups for her, for her invention area. But she called me the other day and she said, I need to make a pie for my son. Can you pick up a quart of ice cream and blueberry pie filling? And I said, sure. And I managed to have 45 minutes to do it. So I did it. Those things don't happen that much, but it was fun. I like those requests.
I have a question. What do you do when you get tired? And I'm asking, I think, for everybody, maybe probably just myself, but I think it will apply to everyone, because it's often this idea of, oh, I'm tired, so, well, I'm tired, I'm going to go to sleep, or I'm going to take a nap. And when your job is, you know, to help to serve other people, you can't just be like, oh, I'm tired, so not going to do that. So how do you manage that?
So I'm actually learning that kind of the hard way right now. So that's a hard question for me, because I'm not doing it very well. You know, I think my body, you know, I'm 54. I've been trying to start this business for a long time, and my body is not necessarily as young as it needs to be for some of the physical stuff.
You're a spring chicken. Spring chicken.
I'm definitely not old, but I don't think that, I think if I was 30, it would be different. So I'm not doing that well. I'm not doing the answer to that question well, which is, you know, kind of taking care of myself, but I understand that I need to. I can't keep going at this pace. Otherwise, there won't be any Sheila Sable, and there won't be any help for anybody. So,
how can people get in touch with you?
Yeah. There's a website. It's www.callsheila, and Sheila is SHEILAH.com, callsheila.com.
So I'm looking down the handout you gave us. It talks about some of the things that you do. I definitely need some of these services, because I still have boxes in my house, packing and unpackaging, packing furnishings. Staging a new home for my friends that know how to decorate. They come to my house and they say, I need a decorator. Hanging pictures, because I still have things in boxes. Disconnecting accounts, utilities, newspapers, coordinating address changes. I mean, man, that's a lot of stuff.
Yeah. And that's that's all stuff that goes along with, you know, moving and relocating, or, you know, changing your space.
Well, listen, Sheila, I'm so glad you came in to talk about your business. Tell our listeners again how they can contact you. Website?
www.callsheila.com, or they can call 518-937-7908.
Thank you. We've been talking to Sheila Sable, founder and owner of Call Sheila, a unique concierge service in the Capital Region.
That concludes our show. We hope you've enjoyed this episode of Hudson Mohawk Magazine. I'm Lavonia Mallory.
And I'm Bree. Remember to tune back in tomorrow and every weekday at 7 a.m., 9 a.m., and 6 p.m. to get your daily dose of local news. You can also get that dose through our Hudson Mohawk Magazine podcast and Facebook page. Also, be sure to tune in 7 to 10 weeknights for Jazz Sanctuary, a wonderful celebration of all that is creative, dedicated to supporting jazz in the Hudson Mohawk region.
As a reminder, WOOC 105.3 is produced by local volunteers. If you're interested in volunteering with our radio efforts, shoot us an email at infomediasanctuary.org, or just stop by one of our weekly meetings on Monday night at 7:07 p.m., held right here at the Sanctuary for Independent Media. Until next time, thanks for tuning in. Thank you.